I wanted to do today a special show for two votes here from Moshe Feinstein, specifically to Hanukkah. To be honest, as I was looking through his various two votes, Rav Moshe does not have some of the most call it interesting questions in like a purely practical sense. I think he was asked some of those questions, like what happens if you're on a plane, do you land on a plane? He was asked some of them, but most of those actually appear not in writing. Most of them were just transmitted to his students, just, you know, orally. So in terms of his writing is actually tends to be a more theoretical. Rav Moshe has almost, you know, two personalities. He was obviously the big posek, everyone asked him questions too, but he also was a Rosh Yeshiva. He also was someone who taught and learned and he published Svarim called the Darash Moshe, which are, you know, very analytically based Svarim. And so some of his tshuvos reflect less of a practical demand and less of a need for practical analysis and more of like a lamdani, more of just like a analysis of the topic in general. And so I picked a tshuva that at first glance, the topic the way it's addressed seems almost entirely conceptual. It seems like it's just like a general conceptual question you could ask, an interesting question. But we'll see is that actually there are some incredibly significant ramifications to how we view this particular issue. The question that Rav Moshe is dealing with, is there a mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles when there will not be Pirsumei Nisa? Now, he doesn't actually elaborate what those examples would be in the beginning of the tshuva. By the end, we'll have covered a number of examples. So anyone want to raise an example of a possible situation in which you would light a Hanukkah candle, but there is no possibility of Pirsumei Nisa?
You're in jail.
You are in jail. Well, maybe other summits could see it, but yeah, in jail.
A blind person who lives by him or herself in a windowless apartment.
So Summa is a different question.
Well, you don't have to be blind because I think Pirsumei Nisa. I mean, it's an interesting question. If you yourself can't see the light, that's actually really interesting. But in Pirsumei Nisa, we're just talking about other people seeing it. So you don't even have to be blind. Just you live alone. You live somewhere where no one else can see you. You live you're trekking in the Arctic, you know. You're in a basement or, you know, and you're quarantined for the week of Hanukkah or 8 days of Hanukkah. Those are all good situations. Times of danger, times of terror, right? You're like stuck in a bunker, you know, during, I don't know, the Blitzkrieg is happening overhead. There are plenty of examples in given. Moshe is going to list some examples where it actually comes up and he's going to talk about it in those examples. I'm not seeing your hand. Excellent. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Rav Moshe is going to talk about that example. Excellent point. Yes, that is exactly true. Thank you. That's true. Sorry, I didn't see your hand before. I apologize. If I don't always see, and now I'll have the screen lecture to have it on. But if I don't see anything, just feel free to call out because I can't see anything. And we can all hear the volume is pretty good. So thank you. Yeah. So Rav Moshe does not actually bring up any of those things I said until the end of the tshuva, which I think does two things. First, is it kind of reinforces this aspect of Rav Moshe being a kind of a conceptual thinker. And we'll talk about, I think this is a very good opportunity for us to talk a little bit of his methodology of how he learns. Because one of the things that makes Rav Moshe unique is not just the way he, you know, the answers he gives, but also the way he arrives at his answers. And the way that he arrives at his answers, the way he learns, is actually very different than most poskim that you otherwise read. I mean, we'll talk about that as we go through the tshuva. And finally, I think it's also interesting just because the question, he's kind of addressing the question. The question was asked in the theoretical sense, and he's responding in the theoretical sense, at least in the beginning. So let's get straight through the tshuva. We'll talk about it. We won't go into all the naughty details, but we'll get through, you know, some of the main issues that come up. So Rav Moshe asked the following question. It's actually a set of questions. If you want to look at the very beginning, it says, Igros Moshe Orachaim Chelek Dalet Simen Kuf Hei. It's a set of questions, a number of questions, the seventh of which deals with Pirsumei Nisa. It was written by Yedidi Neched Gisi, the grandson of my grandson-in-law, so he's like his great nephew or something of the sort, of Rav Yaakov Ephraim Halevi, Leibovitz, as we find out in different tshuva. And it was written, if you want to look at the date was written on the 15th of Tevet, Tavshin Lamed Tet. So you can imagine this is 1979. You can imagine someone, 5 days after Hanukkah realizes, hey, I have all these interesting questions. Let's figure out what to do next year if this never comes up. Mm-hmm. So right after Hanukkah, this guy asks a number of this this great nephew of Moshe asks him this question, and Moshe answers the following question. Right, this is the beginning of the Tshuva. Section Zion. In Pirsum Anes Me'akev Mitzvah Ner Chanukah, does Pirsum Anes, does the concept of Pirsum Anisa, is it Me'akev, is it, is fulfillment of the Mitzvah contingent upon the fact that it's going to be publicized? So he says, Hine Leniyot Daiti, Mistaver Bipshitu, the Gam Ner Chanukah, Eina Pirsum Anisa, Ikuv, La'etza Machiyot Lakat Nerot. He thinks that no, when it comes to Pirsum Anisa, it is not Me'akev, you do not need Pirsum Anisa to fulfill the Mitzvah. How does he prove this? Right, so here, this is kind of where the first question of ideology, of how of methodology comes up. Right, how do you prove this? So if you were like a classic posek, what you would do, you would start quoting a bunch of, you know, predecessors. You start looking for other people, maybe address similar type of questions. That's the way you do it. What does Rav Moshe do? Rav Moshe always goes back to the original sources. That for Rav Moshe is the first thing. Because for him, what when we talked about this in the past, but I think this is a good chew to flesh it out. For him, what's most important is he wants to look at the topic as a whole, the sugya, on his own. He's almost looking at it with fresh eyes, and he wants to see it for himself, come up with his own rationalization, his own svara, and at the end of it, he's going to then conclude and see, like, oh, does everyone else agree with me, or am I going completely against tradition, right? Am I bucking tradition, in which case I'm going to take a step back. But if, but at least prima facie, like his first intuition, is going to always be when you look at the sources. So there are no direct sources that talk about this, but what there is there may be analogous cases, midami milta lamita, something similar to it. So what situation, is there a similar scenario in which the question of presuming nisa being me'akev the mitzvah? Purim, exactly. So interesting question, can you fulfill the mitzvah of Purim, which mitzvah specifically? Megillah. Exactly, because the other mitzvah, some of the others, you know, it'd be impossible. You can't do Mishloach Manot when no one's around. But when it comes to reading Megillah, can you read Megillah alone? And so, you know,
is there a concept of Pirnus Pirsum Anisa to you? In other words, why does it have to always be outwardly directed? Why can't it be inwardly directed? And therefore, you know, the fact that you're actually doing the mitzvah is being a farsame, you know, your behavior to yourself, that this is, it's important for me enough to do it, even in the bunker, even in the, because it's a pure sum hanes for yourself, as opposed to not doing it. It's like no, and now positive.
Actually, a really interesting question. Rav Moshe certainly does not address it. His kind of intuition is that Pirsum Anisa, by definition, has to be publicized, mefarsim, to publicize to others. But it is an interesting question. It's not brought up here. And
it's reminding yourself.
It's only it's only an interesting question. I don't want to dismiss it anyway. It's just not dealt with here, and I can give you my own like answers, but I think it's really it's like worth its own exploration. I don't want to like short change it, you know, by responding here. So when it comes to Pirsum Anisa on Megillah, when it comes to Megillah, so the simple rule, and this is, you know, pretty applicable to all of our lives. When it comes to Megillah, Maishnah Megillah, the Sarach Likro Afkeshu Yachid Beveto. It's obvious that you can read Megillah at home alone, right? In Maishnah B'chol Yom, every year people read Megillah themselves, right? You're sick at home or whatever it is. Someone comes to you, or you know, if you can read it yourself, read it yourself. Like it happens every single year. So everyone, it's clearly obvious you're able to read it on your own. However, here's where the question comes up a little bit, and he's kind of deflect this as a proof. But there is a discussion in the Gemara about whether or not you need to have a minion. You need to have 10 people, not necessarily 10 men only. There's the discussion of the happy men, 10 or 10 people in general, whether you need to have a minion of people present during the Megillah. And there's a machloka in the Gemara, and we're not going to go through all the details, but the way that the normative psak, or Asi's shita, is that the Rav shita is that you differentiate between situations of Bismana versus Shlo Bismana. That if you're reading Megillah at its proper time, meaning on the 14th, of Adar, when you live in, you know, in a non-walled city, or 15th if you live in Jerusalem. So then, if you read it at the proper time, there's no need for a minion. If you read it at the wrong time, and I'll explain what that means, wrong time in a second, then you would need a minion. What does the wrong time mean? So if you've learned the first Mishnah in Megillah, the first Mishnah in Megillah says, Megillah Nikrei, B'yud Aleph, B'yud Bet, B'yud Gimel, B'yud Dalet, Tedvav. You can read the Megillah and Tzayin. You can read the Megillah on a bunch of different days in Adar. why did they have this whole, you know, smorgasbord of options of when you can read the Megillah? Because they made a special takana for the krachim, for all of the villages that didn't have readers, people who did not know how to read. They were, you know, they're rural villages. And so people would come to marketplace on Mondays and Thursdays. And so they were talking that you could read the Megillah in the marketplace, even if it's a few days early, so that they would keep those people who otherwise would not be able to hear the Megillah because they know how to read would have the opportunity to read the Megillah in the marketplace. That's what the first ruling in the Megillah, that's the first Mishnah in Megillah states. So you're allowed to read the Megillah, therefore, in theory. Let's say, you know, Purim falls out on a Sunday, right, the 14th of the Sunday. So you're allowed to read the Megillah on the Thursday before, on the 11th. That's the rule of the Mishnah states.
If it's a leap year, where you would normally do it the second month, you do it the second month, could you do it in the first month?
Really interesting question. You do it in the first month? I think the normative talk is no.
Okay.
But it is an interesting question. If Pidi Abed, it would count. Maybe we make another bracha. I think there is some discussion about it, but I think normatively the answer is no. So that's the basic rule, that if you're reading the Megillah outside of the time, then you wouldn't need a minion of 10 people. So the Rav Moshe is effectively dealing with this question. He's trying to prove that that generally, if you're doing the mitzvah on time, there's actually no need for a minion, and therefore that proves that there's definitely no need for Pirsum HaNes when reads Megillah at its proper time.
That assumes Pirsum HaNes means a minion, because, you know, it could.
Yes, he's equating here Pirsum HaNes with minion. I mean, Megillah is its own.
You have to make sure your Hanukkah candles are going to be seen by nine other people.
Right. It's certainly not true. That's not true. But it is an interesting point that he's equating, in effect, the obligation for a minion and Megillah with Pirsum HaNes, even for Megillah. That's kind of what he wants to extend it to. And so it's not so evident that the need for a minion is based on Pirsum HaNes' concerns. I mean, he's going to dismiss this anyways. But even the fact that he's considering it is a really interesting question. If we're learning, you know, Purim stuff, then I would talk a lot about the fact that that's not in any way obvious, that the minion concern is a Pirsum HaNes issue. But it certainly, I mean, it makes sense. It's not a crazy idea, but it's certainly not very intuitive. So either way, Rav Moshe wants to prove that all of this special concern of the need for 10 people is a special din only in cases of the krachim, only in these non-perm days. And he says as follows, V'lo dami leha d'shlo b'zman b'asar d'ha b'ikuva d'b'lo asar y'kron t'ha b'kfarim d'leka p'risim anes mishum d'kevan sh'adayin leka chiyuv divided leka kfarim leka chiyuv l'kro akodim purim ela shu reshut v'lachein tzarech l'chol apachot shiv ofen shiv resim anes. He explains, why do you need 10 people? Why do you need a minion of people if you read the Megillah before it's a proper time, right? If you read it on the 11th instead of the 14th. So he explains, because there is no mitzvah of Megillah on the 14th, on the 11th. There is mitzvah on Megillah on the 14th. And so you're able to fill the mitzvah on its own, despite the fact that there is no Pirsum HaNes at that moment, because you're reading it alone.
You still do a bracha?
Yes, you still make a bracha. You make a bracha, you know, Asanisim, you make all the brachos. And you make a Shachyanu, you make all the brachos, regular brachos. But when it comes to, if you're reading before its proper time, so you, what do you have in front of you? You don't really have the mitzvah in its proper time. You don't really have this chiyuv. And therefore, Moshe argues, that may be why you need a minion, because the minion, this idea of Pirsum HaNes is going to kind of create the chiyuv. You kind of have to compensate for the fact that there is no natural obligation that's incumbent upon you based on the day itself. And this is something we may see at the end of the Chabur, that there's some type of connection here between the day of itself creating a chiyuv and you needing to sometimes supplement and create that chiyuv yourself. And sometimes that supplementing requires Pirsum HaNes. So that's Rav Moshe's basic argument. It's not really relevant to us nowadays, as I mentioned, but it's really Rav Moshe's main theoretical arguments. He kind of goes back and forth on a bit. He ends up making a point later on how we define what day is the real day of Purim, because he makes the point that, oh, even on those days, if you could read Purim on those days, then you would not, there would be an Isser of Hesped Vitani, an Isser of fasting and eulogizing on those days. And so Rav Moshe says what redefines Purim is not necessarily the prohibitions, rather what defines Purim is whether or not whether we recite ala nisim in tefilo, birkat hamazon. This is the underlined section. Ubirkat hamazon, ve'in korin kata Torah, ve'inosim suda b'yodaled, ve'kish shiluach manot b'yodaled. Whether or not you perform all the mitzvot, do you perform shiluach manot, do you perform suda, do you read kriyas Torah, do you make ala nisim in davening? These things would define when Purim is, and anything else, though you may be able to fulfill the Megillah reading early, it's not really Purim. That's Rav Moshe's main tenet. He ends up going through some of the shitot, and it gets a little bit complicated. I have it in front of you if you'd like. He ends up pointing out at the end of the day, the Ladina Gam Hein Pasku Karav, everyone seems to, even if you disagree on, you know, there's some discussion in the Amoraim, so even if you disagree what the interpretation of any particular Amoraic position is, at the end of the day, the Halacha ends up following the Shita of Rav, and Rav believes that there's no need for a minyan in almost any case. So if we end up passing that way, it doesn't really matter. But what's relevant to us, now I just want to make a point to this, is that Rav Moshe is effectively trying to understand this Gemara. He goes through the different steps and different Shita, and he really goes back and forth, and it really gets pretty convoluted in terms of how he thinks through it. He's really thinking all the possibilities. Because for him, the only text that really matters in this scenario is really the Gemara itself. And he's kind of really presenting the options. Like, you know, this is option A, how to read the Gemara. This is option B, this is option C, option D. And it's a little bit, it's not, you know, as clear cut as maybe you would like it to be. It's a little bit, it takes some work to realize like all the different options as he's reading through it. But he is really trying to come up with in his own sense of which option makes the most sense, which is the most coherent option, and how to read the Gemara properly. And then he says at the end, this is even relates to like in terms of how he views Psak, them istavrish lo yeh machloket rechoka kokach. He says there are different opinions in the Rishonim. How do I understand even the Rishonim themselves when they are interpreting the Gemara? So he says, I'm going to have certain principles of how to understand Rishonim, one of which is that the Rishonim should have smaller machlokets. We want to limit the disagreement. We believe in some type of like parsimonious disagreement between people. It should be limited, it should be small. And therefore, he thinks at the end of the day, Likuli Alma in Inyan Pirsum Me'akev et Etzem Mitzvah Nakriya, when it comes to Kriyat Megillah, there is no inherent issue of Pirsum Anes that requires you to have, that prevents you from performing the Mitzvah of Megillah. And therefore, just like by Megillah, the Imkain, this is the second last paragraph, or the underlined paragraph at the bottom of that first page. When it comes to Chanukah, the same thing is true. You do not need Pirsum Hanes to fulfill the mitzvah of Chanukah.
Why does everybody say that it is?
Oh, why did Ella, why do you need Pirsum Hanes? Ella, the Indian that Pirsum the code, din, the Tsarach Lasso, the mitzvah of Pirsum. There's this extra din, and if we see, I don't know if we have time for it, but there's another chuba, he kind of goes in. It's a hitter mitzvah of sorts. He kind of equates it to Mehadrin or Mehadrin Mina Mehadrin. There's, you know, different levels of Chanukah performance. So the basic level, the, you know, Neri Shubeto level, not exactly the same thing, but the most basic level of Chanukah performance does not require any Pirsum Hanes, does not require any publicizing. You can do it on your own. No one else in the room is with you. That is fine.
All the talk in the Makaros about putting it outside, and if you can't put it outside, you put it in the window, and if people can't see it in the window, you
all of that is a hitter.
That is just for hitter mitzvah.
Absolutely, that's our motion contention. Yeah, it's not everyone agrees with him, but this is certainly his contention, and I actually think I'm actually not sure how widespread in terms of the ideology of in terms of methodology of Psak this is, but it is certainly his contention. Okay, that's his main point. Yeah. Okay, then he keeps going. And now he continues in the kind of his proof, and he brings an opinion, and this kind of, in terms of the methodology, as I pointed out, his first thing he quotes is the Gemara itself and his own analysis. And now he's going to quote an actual opinion that appears in the poskim, but he only quotes it kind of at the end, right? After he's already had, you know, and this is, I cut out a lot. So this is not just a page long, it's really like 3 pages long of analysis on this topic. Mm-hmm. After he already had that 3 pages long of analysis, he says as follows. Venira is in the very last paragraph on the first page. Venira says Shizehu Mashikatov Ashilta Giborim in Shabbos, Dachsanim Shimarias, Shinira Be'inav. He quotes this opinion of the Ashilta Giborim. It's opinion in one of the Rishonim, not the most mainstream Rishonim, but it, as you'll point out, it's actually quoted Lalacha in the Shar Tzion of Mishnah Berurah. But he says this is the opinion, we don't necessarily possibly exactly like this, but this is an opinion that appears in the postgame. Shinir be'enav. Shim haya omed bein hanachrim. Afa pi she'ein lo bayit la'afmo ve'lo petach la'afmo. Chayav la'adlik ner la'afmo. Afa pi she'ishto madlik be'beto. That if you are in a situation where you're alone in a non-Jewish town and there are no other Jews around, and his assumption is that there is no pirsum hanes with non-Jews. Pirsum hanes is only for other Jews. If I actually think this is pretty accepted, even though nobody says it, but it, I think it actually is pretty accepted. There's what to talk about, but he doesn't go into it. He just kind of assumes it here. But you're in a town alone with no other Jews. You're very, you know, very non-Jewish town, and you would think lehefach. Yeah, you could have argued that there's no pirsum hanes, right? Yeah, but that's only the assumption here. So you're in a town where there's no Jews, and you're traveling, right? You're traveling on business to somewhere, you know. I don't want to name a town because there's a Chabad everywhere. But you know, assuming there's no Chabad wherever you are, you're in the middle of the Vatican, the actual, you're in the Sistine Chapel. Yeah. You know, there's no Chabad. The Pope's for Jews. Yeah, all right. Yeah. All right, you're somewhere where there are no Jews. I don't know how it comes up with this. Is pre Chabad, or you know, the Rebbe was still alive. He hadn't spread it. But the Torah same way, yeah.
Iran.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not really. Afghanistan. The guy left Afghanistan, the last Jew.
Right.
Oh, he did leave. Yeah, you're in. It'd be equivalent. It'd be equivalent, exactly. It'd be true if he was an abandoned island, too. But either way, case is, and you know that someone at home, in this case, he's probably your wife, but someone at home is lighting on your behalf. And so the Shilta Giborim, it's not necessarily the way we paskin, but the Shilta Giborim thinks that you should still light on your own and make a bracha. Right? Even though you know that they're going to light on your behalf, maybe even called them up, you video chatted with them, you know for sure they're going to light for you. Nonetheless, you should still light on your own and make a bracha, even though there's going to be no Pirsum Nisa because no one Jewish is going to see the lights. And this shita, he says, of course later on, v'chein hevi, this is the beginning of the second page, hevi b'shar tzion, simen tafer shayin bet, b'shem sefer chemet moshe, mehadei shilta giborim shem riaz. This is quoted in the shar tzion. The shar tzion is the Mishnah Berurah's own kind of footnotes. So Mishnah Berurah's footnotes, he records this very position, which apparently makes it, you know, it truly has halachic weight. But as I pointed out, Rav Moshe only quotes this, but this would clearly be the most relevant position. But Rav Moshe is only quoting this, you know, at the very end of the discussion, after he's kind of made his own conclusion. So that's kind of Rav Moshe's main point, and this seems to cohere very well with his main point, that there is a mitzvah of pirsum hanes, a mitzvah of lighting the Hanukkah candles, even if there is no pirsum minisa. That's kind of point one. Now Rav Moshe is going to ask a question on this. It's still a theoretical conceptual question, but it is an interesting question to think about, which is the following. There is a time limit when you can light the Hanukkah candles, right? When can you start lighting Hanukkah candles?
Before it's
right.
42 minutes.
So the expression is achetichle regel min hashuk, right? When people are walking around. So it's when, you know, sunset officially starts, and then until people are still walking around, and then there's a lot of debate, you know, in a city like Manhattan, how long that lasts. A lot of debate about that.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of discussion about that. But either way, there is two very prominent opinions that appear in Rishonim as to how to understand the end point of lighting. If you miss the point of Tichler Agam Min HaShuk, let's say you live in a suburb, and really I grew up in like a suburb like Teaneck. After like 10 p.m., there really is no one out on the street. I mean, there's like a few cars, but there are very few people on the street. So you're lighting at 10 p.m. in a suburb, and can you still light? And so the normative psak, the way we posit is yes, you should still light, even if there's no one on the street, you should still light, as long as it's still nightfall. If it's early in the day, you missed it. But there is another opinion, a very prominent opinion, that actually believes you should not light. And so Moshe wants to discuss that opinion, because it is a prominent opinion, it's not just a random opinion, it's a very prominent opinion, you should not keep lighting. And so if there is a deadline where you can no longer light, then presumably that deadline, what is motivating that deadline? Pirsum Nisa. And so if Pirsum Nisa is motivating that there is a deadline, and now, what?
Then how does he deal with this?
And how do you deal with the fact that Pirsum Nisa is not me'akev, it's not conditional to performing the mitzvah, right? We can't have it both ways. And now we can have it both ways, but Rav Moshe quotes that the Shilta Giborim, the opinion we just cited above that says that if you're on an island or you're, you know, in the middle of the Vatican, you know, and no Jews are going to see you and you're lighting alone, you should still make a bracha on for lighting the candles. That very opinion believes there's an end point for when you can light the Hanukkah candles. And so isn't this a very clear stira, a very clear contradiction between these, you know, very two obvious problems? So one answer would have been, yeah, you're right. And Rav Moshe's first initial analysis was wrong. His analysis of the Shilta Gemorim was wrong, and he has to reinterpret it differently. But Rav Moshe is very convinced by how he understood it the first time. His intuition feels very strong. And instead, he wants to suggest that this other opinion, this thing we don't possibly like, but it's very prominent, that there is an end time to when we can light the menorah, that time actually must be understood in very different sense. V'tzarech lomar, this is the third paragraph on the second page. V'kevan shebitchilat halayla hu gam bezman she'ikar p'sumah, she'lo kala mi'regam ha'shuk, v'gam belozeh haya ikar hazman dezrizin makdimin, lo ratzu l'takein she'ye zman hadlaka b'di'eved, gam achar zman bishvil elu, she'ein choshim lezrizut, v'ein choshim lemitzah min ha'mofkar, she'ein rotzin levatal melachtan. Rav Moshe answers that effectively the rabbis, when they established the mitzvah of Hanukkah, they established, according to his opinion, established an end time because they wanted people to perform the mitzvah at its earliest juncture, its earliest possibility. They didn't want people to just let it go, you know, wait till 10 p.m. And not consider how important this mitzvah was. They wanted them to come home from work early. They wanted them to consider how important this mitzvah was and to do it right away. Zrizin makdim le mitzvot, you know, the earlier you do the mitzvah, the better. And that's why they established the mitzvah. And almost, you know, it's almost, they almost penalize someone that if you wait too long, then according to this opinion, you miss your chance.
Like eating the Afikoman, right? They make it chatzos, even though you really do it all night, but they don't want you to take a chance to fall asleep and miss it or something.
Looks like the first Mishnah in
Brachos. Right. So those two examples, yeah, Moshe doesn't actually talk about Afikoman, there's what talk about it's very similar, but Moshe actually quotes exactly this first Mishnah in Brachos, exactly. And he says, Hagidol, where do you see the proof to this? Uh-huh. Now, next paragraph, you know, you can write the next Moshe two of yourself.
Sure.
The Hagidol of Mizet, Chazinan Deshach, Gam La'akar, I'll explain to me what I mean. Gam La'akar of Lesser, Nikai Mitzvah. So where is the proof to this, that the rabbis set certain boundaries and kind of penalized you or prevented you from performing a mitzvah if you waited too long because they wanted to ensure that you do the mitzvah at its proper time and didn't wait? So where is a good example of this? So the first Mishnah in Brachot, this one is a quote, says that Ikar and mitzvah of Kriyat Shema is that Kriyat Shema can be read all night long. However, and that's the Shita of Rabbi Eliezer. However, the Chachamim's view in the first Mishnah in Brachot is that you have until Chatzot. You have until midnight about, or
halfway between them and the sundown.
A halachic midnight. Halachic midnight, Chatzot. And there are different ways of interpreting it, but certainly one way to interpret it, the way that Tamid Rabbi Yonah interprets that particular statement, is that the rabbis decided to cancel the mitzvah after Chatzot. That if you missed your chance, if you waited till after Chatzot, you missed it. You're no longer Yotze. There's no mitzvah of Kriyat Shema. You shouldn't make no brachot on it. You missed your chance. That's the way that the Tamid Rabbeinu Yonah understand that Mishnah. And therefore, it seems to be a very good proof that the rabbis have this ideal where we want people to perform mitzvah at certain times, and they're going to, in effect, penalize you and even cancel, you know, mitzvah d'oraita. Right? The fact that they can do it on a mitzvah d'oraita is a real testament to how firmly they believe in this concept. And certainly, you know, kal v'chomer, certainly they can do so even when they are themselves establishing the mitzvah to begin with, right? Because mitzvah of Hanukkah is, after all, the derabanan mitzvah established by the rabbis. Ulefi zeh, this is the next paragraph after that, hu rak inyan hazman v'avatchat hazman zeh, af shenizdam el echad shu yechid b'makom nachrim, af yechid b'ligamre, shelo shayach b'sum enisa hu chayv al kohanim b'adlaka. And therefore, his conclusion is that these two concepts work simultaneously together. That on the one hand, Pirsumi Nisa is not me'akev. You do not need other people to see the menorah for you to fulfill the mitzvah. But at the same time, according to some opinions, there still is an end point for when you can fulfill the mitzvah, not because of Pirsumi Nisa concerns, but because the rabbis establish it in such a way to make ensure that people perform the mitzvah at its proper time and do not wait to do it later.
And that would be why would they make it having to do with people walking on the street as opposed to chatzos like they do with the other mitzvahs?
It's certainly established the main time is going to be Tichareg HaMinashuk, because they want Pirsumei Nisa, they want people on the streets to see it.
Pirsumei Nisa is optimal, but it's not L'Katchila. You have to have it, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah, but according to the position that they create an end time, then the end time is going to reflect not necessarily Pirsumei Nisa. It's really just about limiting the time. So it began, you know, if they began at, you know, 2 a.m, it'd still end at 5 a.m. You know, it's just like they want to limit it to like a smaller window so that you have to perform it in that small window.
And you think there's a conceptual link between how you do the mitzvah, say Ner Abeso, or all everybody in the house lighting all candles on all nights, these and also time. Whereas you'd think if it was just a one Ner per person, and we just lit it for the whole house every night, one Ner, there's not so much of a Pirsum anyway. Maybe you that the most.
Well, it's not clear Ner Ishubeto versus Mehadrin or Mehadrin Mehadrin is based on Pirsumei Nisa concerns. I mean, I'm not sure if Moshe believes, but I don't think it's so obvious. So in case that wouldn't really totally apply. But there, I guess, are interesting questions of like if there were. I'd have to think of a good example of where that comes up, but it is an interesting question of whether timing would relate to it. It's an interesting question. Yeah.
Sorry, Adam.
All right. So that's Rav Moshe's main contention, and that's why Rav Moshe says that he believes. I think he actually ends up posting like this Shilta Gibor, his opinion is quoted in the footnotes of the Mishnah Berurah in the Shart Zion, that Mechadish Yodiyoter, She'af She'ishto Yidlika Beito V'yatza Etzem Mitzvah Yidlaka, Na Mechad Mishim Ru'iyah, if you are alone in the house, and your wife, even if you're traveling on business and no one else can see the lights, you should still make the bracha, despite the fact that there's no Pirsumei Nisa. That's the intuition, that's the contention he has generally. Yeah, Bella. Yeah, so I mean, first of all, there are a lot of Jews in New York. There's like a million Jews everywhere. But it's an interesting question. I don't know if certainly Chabad has a very different conception of Hanukkah in general and Pirsumei Nisa than most poskim do. I mean, Chabad lights with a bracha every time they do a big candelabra, even if it's the person's 50th lighting of the night. Most poskim would say they should not. But Chabad has its own way of reading the poskim. The way he understood the Gemara and the Shulchan Harav's psak. So they have their own, they have the reason to do it, for doing so, but it's certainly their own psak. I'm actually not sure what they say about non-Jews particularly. I actually am kind of curious to look this up later, what the Shulchan Harav or the Rebbe, you know, writings would say about non-Jews. But it is an interesting question about Pirsumei Nisa in general about Jews. Well, that's in terms of performing the mitzvah. I'm not sure if that's true about who's watching it, though. I'm not sure they're concerned about that Jews are present to see the menorah lit or
Hadlaka or Hanachos, Mr. Right? So it would be.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly mocking that a Jew is lighting. I mean, they're not going to make a non-Jew make a bracha. That, I mean, like, they're not going that far for curious. But I do think I'm not sure. I'd have to ask a Chabad person what they think, and I'm kind of curious what the Shulchan Aruch Harav, you know, their main posek would have to say about it. I'll have to get back to you guys about that. Interesting question. Okay, so that's Ramosha's main contention. That's kind of his main point, and then also Ramosha finally is going to get into some of the halachic discussions, because Ramosha, let's kind of bring it more practically. Venicha. The Fize, this is the fifth paragraph on the second page. Finally, the Moshe is going to finally start bringing about a practical ramification of this. Is going to be, besides the person visiting alone, traveling alone, and speaks to no Jews, another ramification of this, the Fize, Mash B'Shat HaSakana, Menichas Shulchana V'Dio. That's why, if you are alone, and it's a place of Sakana, it's a dangerous situation outside, there's, you know, something dangerous at riding outside, there's, you know, pogroms, whatever is happening, there's blitzkrieg, you know, whatever is happening, something's dangerous outside. That's why the halacha, simple halacha, is you don't have to put menorah at the window. You can put the menorah on your table, close the shades, and that's fine. It doesn't matter. Velo nomar, and nonetheless, you're going to be fulfilled the mitzvah entirely. Don't say, oh, there's a special takana for sakana. In case of danger, there was a special, you know, leniency, but usually this isn't the rule. Your Moshe says, no, the rule is you do not need Persumi Nisa. There's no special leniency. Of course, it's better to have Persumi Nisa, but it's not a specific leniency that they made like in exigent circumstances. That's not what happened. Now Rav Moshe is going to come to something actually very, very practical. And he's going to quote that the main shita, the main sock of Rishon that we said, that I quoted earlier, is that if you miss the time for lighting, there is no end time, right? You can really light all night long. That's the way the Shulchan Aruch, that's the way Shulchan Aruch paskins, that's the way that the Ramah paskins, that's the normative psak. You're allowed to paskin all night, you're allowed to light the menorah all night long. But here's the question that I think Bella brought up earlier. What if you come home late after everyone is asleep? So what do you do? So just to give you a sense of the poskin, just so you can compare Moshe, because I wanted to show the comparison in terms of Moshe's own methodology. So if you want to turn to the beginning of page 3, I quoted just the Mishnah Berurah. It says the following, Mishnah Shachar said you can light all Tolala. This is in the fourth source one. And then he says, Adam was Shachar until, you know, daybreak. And it's a bracha. Behainu davka im b'nei habayit ne'urim. And that specifically, you can only light all night long if people in the house are awake and will see you making lighting. If though people are sleeping or there's no one around in the house, then Mishnah Berurah's main psak is you should not make a bracha. That's Mishnah Berurah's main psak based on the Magen Avraham.
Even though it's a hakel for the Rabbanan to make a bracha, you're always, well, that's why you're makel when you're makel. When you're dealing with brachos de Rabbanan, right? So this way you don't say the bracha.
Yeah, that's why you wouldn't say the bracha. Yeah, right. You'll say it in a second shark soon, yeah. Yeah, but either way, that's the main point. And I mean, you're not getting a Ramadan based on some bracha.
You don't have to make a bracha for it to be a mitzvah. So if you're not sure, then it would make sense not to say the bracha because we don't make brachas when there's a doubt.
Yeah, you know, we'll get to that in a second. But that's actually not the operating principle here. He actually just thinks, in principle, if there's no one watching it, there should be no bracha. However, the shark seon, that's based on the Magen Avraham. You can see footnote 17. So the source 2, I quote footnote 17, Shara Tzion. He quotes Magen Avraham. That's based on the Magen Avraham, this psak that you cannot make a bracha if no one is around awake. However, he quotes Mesefer Chemed Moshe, Herich Bazeh. The Chemed Moshe ends this argument. Vedato, and he argues that ideally, Kulam Yakit Bet Ugimel Meham, ideally you should wake people up. That's ideally what you should do. If it's impossible, a lot to both discuss, like how far, you know, how much effort should you put into waking someone up. There's a lot to discuss about that. But if it's impossible to wake someone up, you should make the bracha. And he bases this based on the Shilta Gibor we quoted earlier on that opinion that Rav Moshe liked. Magen Avraham disagrees. He thinks they should make the bracha. And Moshe says no, or, you know, the poskim. This is not the way most postmen agree. And the end of the day, the Shaar Tzion Mishnah Berurah quotes in his footnotes, Kain Yerli V'chein Ogin Olam, with Savik Brachol LaHakel. How does he paskin? He thinks Savik Brachol LaHakel. And therefore, you should not make a bracha, because in cases of doubt, we have this big debate between the Chemed Moshe and the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham thinks no bracha, Chemed Moshe thinks yes bracha. And therefore, Savik Brachol LaHakel, no bracha, because in cases of doubt, brachot are derabanan. We prefer not to make a bracha v'tala. We prefer just not making one. However, if you want to paskin like the Chemin Moshe, make the bracha. Gevalt, you know, you can do so. We're not going to complain. We're not going to say anything bad.
The only other person there is your spouse. Because a person and their spouse is considered like what, right? For a lot of halakhic principles. So, like, if it's my wife and me, do you make a bracha or not?
You would
under the more machmir.
I think you would even according to machmir position. But it's an interesting point because if you look even at these shitas, they seem to quote waking up both people,
right,
which isn't even a concern about your wife. It's really a concern about one person not being good enough.
That's why I mentioned wife because it doesn't specifically.
Yeah, so there are a lot of minute details here that are worth talking about, like how much effort should you put into waking someone up according to Nekel shita. There's certainly a lot of if you have like kids who are going to start crying and yelling, or you know, or someone had a very long day and it's like they're exhausted, they have like a night shift, they're working at the hospital or whatever it is, they're really supposed to wake them up. So there's a lot to discuss, but that's not really our point of discussion here. I just wanted to quote so you have like a sense of what the halakhic literature was. This is before Rav Moshe. This is written, you know, Mishnah Berurah. I don't know exactly when he wrote this particular psak, but it's in the early 1900s. And so Rav Moshe is writing in, I think we said 1979. So he's writing, you know, many years later, and he knows Mishnah Berurah. He's going to quote it, actually. And nonetheless, despite the fact he knows what normative halakha is, he's going to say that based on his own intuition, his whole analysis until now, what do you think his conclusion is? Based on what he said so far for Rav Moshe, what is his conclusion going to be?
You don't wake them up.
You probably don't even have to wake them up. Yeah, you make the bracha. He doesn't actually say that much. Yeah, it's actually interesting. He doesn't actually say that much about waking him up. Mm-hmm. But he definitely should make the bracha. And therefore he says, if you want to look at the, he says, this is the very end of that paragraph, for the new title, the underlined part, Mechuyev Levarech, the Shita Magin Avram Tamua. He thinks the Magin Avram's position is difficult. And therefore he thinks against the Magin Avram, against what seems to be normative psak, you should definitely make the bracha. And he says even further, he keeps talking about it a little bit more. He quotes a little bit more about the Shita. We just saw it inside in the sources. He says the whole, and he says as well, the Mashi Katam, this is the line, the last paragraph, the line before it gets underlined. This actually goes back to your point. The Mashi Katam, the Magin Avram, who dafka kshiyakis b'nei beito, v'loyal in shechin in v'tam, the Magin Avram, who is mechayev to wake people up, and if you don't wake people up, then it's not, you cannot make the bracha. That makes no sense to me. Rather, here's the online part. Aval dibri Magin Avram temuim. The Magin Avram's position is very difficult. It's very hard to understand. V'tzarich leadlik bevracha afkish bnei habayit ishenim v'afkish hurak levado b'bayit. You have to make the bracha even when people are sleeping in the house. He doesn't make an effort discussion of even waking them up. Maybe you don't have to wake them up. It's not really clear here. Even if you're alone in the house, the gamrak lebechol ear, even if you're the only person in the whole city, you're, you know, you're an expedition in the Arctic and there's no one else around you. Tzarich ladlik bebracha uktiv be'arti. You still have to make a bracha. And it's not the Kedavim Mishnah Berurah. And Mishnah Berurah says, quoted Chaim Moshe, and he disagrees even with the point of the Mishnah Berurah about Mishnah Berurah said something bracha lehakel, and Rav Moshe thinks no, we did not say something bracha lehakel. Mishnah Magin Avraham's position is wrong. Mm-hmm. We reject it out of hand, and therefore you should definitely make a bracha. And so this tshuva, I think, is interesting not only because it makes an interesting principle about Hanukkah and it, you know, elaborates on some of the principles, operating principles in some of the sugyos, but it's also interesting in terms of methodology that Rav Moshe is really willing to go out of his way to just disregard and disagree with the Magin Avraham. And the willingness to do that, I think, stems from his methodology. That if he was someone who was, you know, based primarily in his analysis on what Poskim said, it'd be very difficult to just reject a different opinion. The only way to reject another opinion would be if, you know, that opinion was outweighed or outvoted, so to speak, by a lot of other opinions, a lot of other, you know, scholarly positions in history. But if you're the only position, but if the only real position is Magin Avraham, Magin Avraham is a really big posting. It's not easy to reject the Magin Avraham, but Rav Moshe is willing to do so because his analysis of Sugya confirms that. And not only that, but the Shaar Tzion quotes an opinion that seems to reflect that same idea, and that gives Rav Moshe enough weight that even though that opinion is still like a minor position, Chaim Moshe versus Magin Avraham, Magin Avraham is going to win almost every time. Nonetheless, Rav Moshe feels that the conceptual position is so significant, he's willing to reject the Magin Avraham out of hand, so much so that he says you have to make a bracha, and it's not even a bracha, it's not even a suffix lahaka. Yes, question, yeah. I'm not sure Bir Chametz is a presuming Nisa mitzvah. I mean, I don't think there's anybody who thinks there is.
Maybe it's a kiyum. No. She's talking about, but Rashi says you can.
Yeah, but I think
you can.
I'm not sure.
Bittol Beliba.
Yeah, I mean, the Rashi is equal.
The question is, because Bittol Beliba.
This is Rashi on Daf Vav. This is Rashi right on Daf Vav, I think. Yeah, Rashi says that. I don't think Bittol or Bir Chametz is mitzvah and piercing my knees. So I'm not sure it's entirely relevant.
You can do believe it, but not to effectively do something positive.
I don't know if there's a lot of discussion about the fact that the lathe is, but Rashi's really negating the need for it to burn it even. That's what Rashi's main point is there. But it's an interesting Rashi to talk about. Yeah, David, did that help you about? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I still don't know if it's, I don't know if he's really talking about Pierce Monet's there, but yeah. David. Yeah, there is a debate about that, yeah. And Mirashi is also commenting whether you need to actually burn it, not just in your mind get rid of the chametz, you know, or negate it, so to speak, in your mind, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really sure who we're talking about. I'm kind of curious. Is Guy Christensen writing a PhD currently on Rav Moshe? And he wrote a PhD on Rav Moshe. Interesting. Okay, so I actually got a curious to read it, what he says. But I don't know his personal analysis of it, but for certainly in, like within postgame, the differentiation between what's called Sveika de Dina versus like Sveika de Maisa is like a very typical differentiation. And then the difference between a suffix between how do we postgame, because we see there's like, you know, Rashi and Tosfot say, you know, Rashi on one side, Tosfot says something on the other side. How do we debate, how do we decide between two of our predecessors? That's a very different type of suffix than a suffix of what happened in a case. Like, did you make a bracha? Did you not make a bracha in the past? So those are different sfeikot. And so I agree with you, and I think it fits in well within our, you know, what I said earlier, was that Rav Moshe is very much willing to insert himself in a case where there's a sfeika d'dina, where there's a suffix about how we paskin, which position we follow, because Rav Moshe ultimately thinks at the end of the day, while he certainly has respect for previous opinions, and he doesn't reject them out of hand, it's very important in informing his opinion, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is going to be his own intuition. And so if there is going to be a sfeika d'dina, a debate between poskim, I think it fits very well that Rav Moshe is going to be willing to actually decide the situation and decide who's right, as he decided here against the Magen Avraham, that we should make a bracha, even if there is no pirsum anes, even if you're alone, even if you're at home after everyone's asleep, you should still make the bracha. That willingness, I think, Rav Moshe is willing to do, as opposed to, you're right, cases where there's like a suffix, did you make a mistake in the past or something of the sort, where Rav Moshe, that type of doubt is a very different type of doubt. So even though we use the word suffix in both situations, they are actually different types of stakeouts. Absolutely.
I think one of the things you can see here, which you also see elsewhere in Rav Moshe, not that I'm an expert in Rav Moshe, but he is very self-aware. He knows he's a gadol. He knows he's just as great as these other rabbanim, like the Magen Avraham or whoever. And so if he starts with the original sources, like they did, and goes all the way through and comes up to a conclusion, I think he's not being a Balgaiva, because he's just being self-aware. He knows he's as great as those people are, so he feels like he can go with his psak, especially if someone who's of some worth actually said the same thing. But even if he didn't, he might have the same psak.
You know? I'm actually not sure I agree with you on this. I actually think, in my contention, of course, Rav Moshe was a god. I don't mean to disagree with that. But I actually think, and maybe we'll go over this once, before people leave, I just want to make, before I answer this, I'm not going to be here next week, so I think the Chabur is going to be canceled for next week. I can't imagine someone covers it. Just so heads up, we're going to be covering no Chabur next week. God willing, we return in 2 weeks on Sunday. But to go back to your question, and maybe we'll cover this, Rav Moshe in his introduction, and he has a few chapters where he talks about this, where Rav Moshe, when he first began Tshuvas, he was already 40 years old, but he was like, no one knew who he was. But he was like not famous in any sense. And people were very surprised who this like little pitcher like suggesting like to go against these big names. Mm-hmm. And Ramoshi wrote in his Chuba that he doesn't necessarily think that he's a big person. But this is, I think, I mean, he certainly had to have, but I think he had a certain confidence in his abilities, not because he believed he was like as great as the Mugen of Rum. I think it's actually just the way that he believed Sock should work, that if you, that people should be able to reach conclusion on their own. That's like the way that he has confidence in our abilities, and that's what he thinks Sock should be like, that they're, it shouldn't just be a Mistura where it's tradition passed on one from the other and it's stale, but every person should inject into tradition, into Psoc, you know, every person who's capable of Psoc.
Everybody can do it.
Everyone is capable. Yeah.
You have to have the goal where you can.
You have to have the confidence to be able to give up Psoc. That's for sure true.
First of all, you, no offense, but you wouldn't make a point and say that you're right and everybody else.
Of course not. No, I don't have that. I don't have
that. You might someday, but not right now.
Of course.
But
2 weeks, yeah, maybe.
You have to have some sort of amount of self-awareness in authority that he was so knowledgeable and he did things so much the right way that he could give a sock that might go against the flow of some other people that other people
absolutely
would never.
You need that confidence, but it's not just confidence. Because I'll give you maybe a better example.
Because like Dhamma, you know, I think I remember just reading this recently. There's this tension that, right, just like you're articulating, that he believes in precedent, but he also uses the word hurrah. You have to have the idea of hurrah, right, of being able to take a matter, decide it, and you know, and.
I don't think there are a bunch of postgame who would not follow Moshe's, not just because they don't believe they have their own same level of Moshe. There are two things. There's certainly you have to reach a conviction, a personal conviction that you have the ability to postgame, 100%. But there are some postgame who, even if they have that conviction, wouldn't feel comfortable going against precedent, not because, you know, they don't have the conviction that they can come up with a decision on their own, but because they would feel that that's just not how Psoc works. Maybe they feel, you know, I think it's almost a methodology issue in some ways. And obviously it has certain theological ramifications to it too, but based on methodology, that's not how they believe they should be able to have the ability to change Psoc. I mean, like if you want like an example in Tanaim, like look at Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. He said like, there's like famous Gemaras where he was asked a bunch of questions, and he didn't answer any of them. And the Gemara, and then the Gemara asked, like, Tamidim asked, like, don't you know the answers? And he said, yes, I know the answers, but I have a principle that I never said anything that lo shamati mirabotai. I never said anything that I didn't first hear from one of my teachers. And I think, that principle of being unwilling to share some Torah that, you know, you didn't first hear from your Mesorah, you didn't hear from your teachers, from somebody that you have some precedent to, is still prevalent, and I could name postgame who believe that way. It's like a little bit present. It's not, or I would say Ravadi may be the best example, but it's really not Ravadi because he actually is a pretty, I'd have to come up with a good example, or a good example. There are a bunch of them. It's pretty prevalent in different degrees for different people, but it's a, yeah, Rav Asher Weiss is very similar to Ramosha in that way.
Yeah.
Rav Asher Weiss, I actually think in a lot of ways Rav Asher Weiss is kind of the next person after Ramosha in terms of who I would like want to like discuss in terms of the historical and analytical frame of mind he comes in bringing it to answering Chubos. But I would say, like, I agree with you that at the end of the day the Ramosha was a gadol and needed that conviction, but I don't think it's true that by dint of having that gadol status, he felt he was on the same level as Magen Avraham. I think he could agree he's not on the same level, but he still has the ability to disagree and reject Magen Avraham.
I thought he was at the same level, but he was at a high enough level that he
could. Yeah, it was a high enough level, yeah. And
objectively, maybe he was at the same level. I don't know. I'm not an expert.
I mean, how do you rank these things? I never know.
But Magen Avraham got there first, so he's in all the Mishnah Berurah books.
I mean, often being on a higher level doesn't necessarily mean more knowledge. It just means earlier and therefore have more precedence and more historical importance.
Those could be more acceptance, you know.
Yeah, and therefore acceptance for that reason. But it's not about like who's smarter, which is the way often Yerza Doros is spoken. Yeah, if anything, it might seem more. Yeah, exactly. But often Yerza Doros is talked about as a discussion of who knows, you know, that the earlier generations were smarter than us, which is.
Yeah.
They don't have Shkafik.
He had a high self.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.